Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the February-March issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Ivan McClellan. Kansas City native Ivan McClellan focuses on black cowboys and cowgirls with the photography project 8 Seconds by Kaylee Brister. He grew up in the Midwest, but it wasn't till Ivan McClellan was living in Portland, Oregon, and took a trip to a rodeo in Okmulgee, Oklahoma, that he became immersed in the Western lifestyle and found a real purpose for his photography. It was at the Roy LeBlanc Invitational Rodeo that McClellan was introduced to the black cowboy community and saw cowboys and cowgirls from all over competing and socializing at the oldest continuously held annual black rodeo in the United States. The experience inspired McClellan to create the photography project 8 Seconds with the aim to expand the cowboy icon to include people of color. The undertaking has garnered significant attention on social media and has landed him photography projects with ESPN, as well as Western giants like Wrangler, Stetson, Boot Barn, and Tecovas. We talked with McClellan about his passion for sharing the stories of black cowboys, his upcoming photo book, and his connection to the West. You grew up in Kansas City. How did you get involved with rodeos and the Western lifestyle? We'd go to the American Royal, which is a big rodeo in Kansas City, when I was a kid. I sang the national anthem there one year. And I had friends that were in agriculture. I had friends that did 4-H and raised cattle and chickens. So it was around me, but it didn't really hook me until about 6 years ago, when I went to a black rodeo in Oklahoma. At that point, I was just blown away that there was such a thriving cowboy culture within black culture, and I just got obsessed with it and kept going back year after year to just be part of it and connect with the folks and hear stories and see the spectacle. Tell us about the rodeo in Oklahoma. How did you discover it? I was working my desk job in Portland, Oregon, and feeling separated from my life in Kansas City. I was at a party with some work friends, and I ran into this other black guy named Charles Perry. He told me he was a filmmaker, and he was working on a documentary about black cowboys. I kind of chuckled because I was like, there's not enough black cowboys to do a documentary, are there? And he said, "You've got to come to this rodeo. You don't know anything about this culture. You've got to come and see what's going on." So I flew to Oklahoma in August. It was 105 degrees. I was just blown away that there were 2,000 black cowboys there. It really opened my eyes to a segment of black culture that I had no clue existed, let alone that a lot of people there were actually from Kansas City. A lot of them travel down there every year during the rodeo for their family reunions. As I got to talk to people and see people that were there riding horses that went to the same high school as me and that people knew my grandma, I realized that it was not only cowboy culture, it was my culture. It was really a part of who I am. It changed my definition of home. It changed me for good in a lot of ways. I owe all that to Charles for being open and inviting me into this world. How did that experience evolve into the idea for a book? When I went to another rodeo, a rodeo in Arizona, and it was completely different. Then I went to another rodeo, and that one was different. I went to a rodeo in Texas, and that was different. I was realizing that this thing wasn't the same everywhere, that it changed. So I really dove deep into the rodeo culture. I was focused on fathers and sons initially. Then I was like, well, what's going on with the women? I started paying attention to the barrel racers and the steer decorators. Then I was like, well, the rodeo is just one event. What's it like at people's houses? So I started going to ranches and people's homes across the country and seeing how they lived their day-to-day lives. Then I was like, well, it's not just ranching and rodeoing, it's farming too. You know, farmers are cowboys. So I started going to farms and looking at cotton farmers and going across the Black Belt and the southern U.S. and visiting peanut farmers. Every time I thought I was close to wrapping it up and putting it all into a book, I would learn something new and dive into that. You photographed a lot of iconic black rodeo athletes, farmers, and cowboys and cowgirls. Has anyone in particular really inspired you? I started out as an outsider and being this strange guy from Portland that was wearing his hat backwards and had on wingtips. I just really didn't fit in. I'm still no cowboy, but I've moved from being an onlooker to having real friends and people that I call on the phone just to catch up. The person I most recently really connected with was Charles Sampson, who's doing the foreword to the book. He's a bull riding legend, the first black man to win a world championship at the NFR. The first black bull rider to win at the NFR way back in the 80s. He rode in front of Ronald Reagan, and he's done all this impressive stuff. I was supposed to go shoot him for a campaign for Wrangler, and I was kind of intimidated. I was like, this is the most decorated bull rider that I've ever met. This is the guy that everybody knows. I was hearing stories from other people about Charles, and they were like, he's a rough and tough guy. I went to meet him, and he was just so nice. He was showing me videos of him bull riding back in the day and telling me stories. We just immediately connected. He's a California boy at heart. He put me on a horse named Pete, and we went and wrangled steers together, and he was yelling at me what to do. I learned a lot that day, and we catch up all the time. Western weddings. From the mesas of New Mexico to the mountaintops of Montana, Western weddings draw inspiration from the region's most beloved backdrops. Here are some inspiring nuptial details that take cues from a sense of place and culture. Jenny and Dave, Jackson, Wyoming. From their meet-cute in Nashville to their upcoming winter wedding in Wyoming, the love story of this happy couple seems fated. But it took a near tragedy to make country singer Jenny Tolman and Grammy-nominated producer Dave Brainerd realize what was right in front of them. C&I knew Tolman from her Nashville-based country music career. We had interviewed her in March 2019 when we premiered a music video for a song called My Welcome Mat, and recently got reacquainted when we got the press mailing for her single I Know Some Cowboys and the news about her upcoming album. Married in a Honky Tonk. We should have seen the hearts, flowers, and fireworks floating around the things she said about her then-producer, now fiancé, Dave Brainerd. Even with all the undercurrents of love, we were stunned when People.com revealed how the two had gotten together as a couple. The headline read, Left for Dead, Nashville producer Dave Brainerd finds love in the arms of singer Jenny Tolman. Jenny and Dave got engaged in Jackson, Wyoming, and are planning a destination winter wedding there, outside in the snow in March. You'll find the whole love story from the romantic proposal and the say yes to the dress gown to the snowy ceremony and the special wedding playlist on cowboysandindians.com. Mountain Rustic. Joanne and Josh, immigrant Montana. Fall in Montana makes for a foolproof scenic backdrop. With decorative accents like wagon wheels and quail feathers peppered throughout the 90-year-old Mountain Sky guest ranch, this wedding incorporated whimsical elements to complement the location's natural ruggedness. For the wedding, it wasn't just the groom from nearby Livingston who embraced the Montana lifestyle. There was a visible effort from the couple, family, and friends, and the team at Wander North Events to celebrate the Western Way. I found it so fitting for Joanna and Josh to incorporate Western details such as pheasant feathers, leather, antlers, brands, and Western attire into every aspect of their wedding day design, photographer Lauren Brown says. Joanna has such an artistic, elevated style that was impossible to avoid while documenting their beautiful day. I love to home in on details that couples incorporate, and Joanna and Josh's wedding was overflowing with these thoughtful touches throughout. For instance, the ring bearer carried an antler with the rings placed on the prongs. Josh's bow tie was made from beautiful feathers, and Joanna and her flower girls wore pheasant feathers in their hair. I loved capturing those details in their true, authentic moments. Authentic environs. Mountain Sky Guest Ranch has the quintessential Old West look and feel, with many of the buildings being authentic. 100-plus-year-old structures, photographer Lauren Brown says. Mountain Sky oozes authenticity, but has been respectfully elevated as an upscale luxury guest ranch. As a third-generation Montanan myself, I'm so appreciative of Mountain Sky Guest Ranch and places like it that have maintained respectfully upgraded and cared for their historic property with such integrity. The old barn, corrals, cabins, and lodge, combined with high-end amenities and top-notch customer service, mirrored the couple's high standards and love for real Montana. Traditional and simple. Katie and Jackson, Pendleton, Oregon. I wanted to get married at home because it is the most important place to my family and it is so beautiful. Bride Katie, who is Nez Perce, Cayuse, Umatilla, and Carrick, says about marrying her real-life ranch and rodeo cowboy, Jackson, in a horse pasture on her family's property. Everything about this celebration took help from their tight-knit community. Her mother made the teepees, and her father set them up. A neighbor assembled the ceremony arch. Her aunts provided their famous farai bread, and cousins, sisters, and friends helped with everything else. People laughing and dancing and telling old stories is something that is printed in my mind, and I will always cherish that entire weekend, Katie says. It was so full of love and community. For her special day, Katie wore a traditional Plateau tribal wedding veil that she made herself. As a lifelong bead worker, she wanted to create one for her wedding that she could also pass down to her family. It was made with dentalium shells, which my people used as currency back in the day, and is also adorned with gold and bronze beads, adding that it took hours to make with the help of her sisters and was surprisingly heavy due to the thousands of beads and shells we used. I haven't actually seen one of those veils except for the one on display at our local tribal museum and various veils from old photos in books at my parents' house. I had seen a beautiful Umatilla woman in a photo wearing one pre-1900 and knew that was exactly what I wanted to wear for my wedding. Southwestern, Madeline and Chris, Tasuki, New Mexico. Think at-home weddings are typically traditional? Not for this bride and groom. Inspired by the Southwest, this couple's celebrations showcased everything from handmade waxen candles to authentic Native American turquoise. Bursting with color at the home of the bride's parents, this wedding honored the spirit, energy, and charisma of the West. This wedding was so stunning in person, says Zara Southard of Maggie's Cakes. The wedding cake itself was a carrot cake, simple and sweet, which works great with the naked cake look. The groom's cake was a Mexican cinnamon chocolate with a cinnamon caramel pinion buttercream frosting. What I like to do is add a little personal touch. Since the groom is a massive Dallas Cowboys fan, we hung little cowboy flags in the doorway of his adobe cake. Embracing New Mexico's iconic regional style, Madeline incorporated pops of color, vintage elements, and authentic Native American jewelry wherever possible. Tried, true, and tribal tradition. These Navajo and Hopi wedding customs celebrate commitment, community, and harmony. Indigenous unions tend to emphasize intention and commitment over material display, with wedding ceremonies and celebrations focusing less on attire, rings, and registries, and more on family and community. A Navajo wedding is more than the uniting of two people, says Mark Bhatti, author of numerous books about indigenous culture, including Pueblo Stories and Storytellers. It is a joining together of families, clans, and communities. Underpinning that union is tangible proof of readiness. Preparations for a traditional Hopi wedding, such as gathering enough corn, might start a year or more in advance. The man's family or clan must provide the bride's traditional woven clothing and meat, butchered sheep, steers, or deer, just prior to the wedding ceremony, while the bride's side must provide cornmeal, pieke bread, sacks of flour, breads, and many types of baked goods. The huge quantity of cornmeal can take a couple of years to gather. Bins, barrels, and large trash cans of shelled corn begin to accumulate in homes on the bride's side. We asked Bhatti to explain more about some of the specific customs and rituals of traditional Navajo and Hopi weddings. Navajo. Traditional Navajo weddings are done at sundown. The bride was not to be seen by the sun or sunlight, so she covers her head, usually with a Pendleton blanket, as she approaches the hogan in which they will be married. In many instances, a new hogan will be constructed for the ceremony. Additionally, a custom still often adhered to is the arrival of the groom and his family at the bride's family home on horseback just before sunset. In such cases, the groom's saddle is taken off the horse and placed inside the bride's house. Fundamentally, the wedding structure rests upon the blessing way, a Navajo way or ceremony used for other purposes as well, and brings blessings to all present. The wedding basket, to hold cornmeal for both prayers and blessings, not just in weddings, is used. The basket is always placed so that the opening faces east, a sacred direction, as that is where the sun rises and therefore a direction from which no harm or evil can come. A singer or medicine man who knows the blessing way opens the ceremony with a prayer blessing. A cornmeal mush is placed in the basket and blessed with corn pollen by the Hatha. Blue cornmeal is the preferred cornmeal for the mush. Water from a gourd is given to the couple to take turns in washing each other's hands before eating, symbolizing purity, a cleansing. The couple is seated so that they face east, alternate eating pinches of the cornmeal mush in a directionally determined manner, beginning in the east and moving in a sunwise direction. Some say the direction's sequence represents four stages of life. Near the end of the ceremony, the Hatha will lecture the couple on their new relationship, marital duties and responsibilities, and how they should behave toward each other and each other's families. Frequently, older family members will also in turn offer advice. Hopi. Since the couple must be from different clans, though the children will always belong to the mother's clan, the ceremony and its extensive preparations are the obligation of two clans. It is the older women of the family who take the lead in organizing the activities, extensive exchanges, rituals, and meals. The man goes to the woman's home, now obligated to farm her fields, and a good-natured mud fight ensues over the stealing of the man by the bride's family. The first part of the ceremony itself involves the bride going to the groom's home for many days to grind corn and cook. In short, to prove she can care for and feed her husband. As the exchange begins, just prior to the wedding, truckloads of meat are brought to the bride's home, and pickup after pickup deliver cornmeal, sacks of flour, and baked goods to the groom's family. Much of these huge amounts of food will be cooked for the guests who will participate over the next several days. Part of the ceremony is the ritual washing of their hair, something that happens in other instances when someone is brought into a family, whether by birth, adoption, or for ceremonial reasons. The couple's hair is traditionally braided together briefly at this time to symbolize the joining together of their lives. At the end of the feasting and blessings, before they leave for the bride's home to start their life as a married couple, they are lectured by members of both families as to how they should behave as a married couple, toward each other, their respective families and clans, and toward their children. But that is not the end. The bride now needs to pay back all her female relatives for their help and food donations. The payback, as it is called, must be done in a different currency, Hopi baskets, several dozens of baskets in most cases. This requires paying for baskets, sometimes with gas, but often with the traditional form of exchange. Baskets. 7 bushels of corn yields about 50 pounds of shelled corn, and while that may cover 1 wicker plaque, far more is required for even a modest-size coiled basketry plaque, and a number of very large ones are called for. It's not surprising, then, that gathering enough baskets for the payback may take several years. Bhatti says one similarity between these traditional Navajo and Hopi weddings customs particularly stands out. They both stress the need for their marriage to reinforce the community and harmony. Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the April issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Editor's note: What April Brings, by Hunter Hawk and Dana Joseph. Celebrating a country queen. Loretta Lynn's legendary career is perfectly encapsulated by a song that's almost synonymous with her name, Coal Miner's Daughter. In its unforgettable verses, Lynn belts her backstory and reveals her lasting source of joy and inspiration. It's a plain-spoken lyrical poem about a little girl who grew up with love and not much else. Yet, there are many more Loretta Lynn songs that pull off the same bit of lump-in-the-throat magic. Her musical gifts are immense, as are the doors she has opened for other authentic country artists. That's why we felt it only fitting on the occasion of Lynn's 90th birthday on April 14th to give her a standing ovation in words and to invite some more of our favorite country singers to do the same. Faces You Should Know. Also represented in this issue are the up-and-coming artists, entertainers, and athletes bringing American indigenous culture to audiences around the world. From the FX Network's hit TV show Reservation Dogs and the latest movie in the Predator franchise to the bull riding circuit and the Mrs. Universe stage, we shine a spotlight on young Native American talents who are taking control of their careers, telling their own stories, and finding success as they emerge as a powerful force in mainstream entertainment. To everything there is a season. It's that time of year when we start dreaming of warmer weather, so we're naturally all about plans for the outdoors and the clothes, food, and travel to match. Start with art and bask in the beauty of Mother Nature with the captivating landscapes of painters Brian Timmer and Topher Strauss. Our big fashion special evokes vacation vibes with lively and lovely fresh color palettes and plenty of fringe, boots, hats, and turquoise jewelry. Our travel stories are sure to give you adventure fever, whether it's yearning to ride the rapids with guides in Utah or to ride the trails with Paniola cowboys in Hawaii. And our culinary feature will get you ready to turn, whatever you've got on the grass grill, that is. And if it's veggies, barbecue maestro Stephen Ricklin will show you the ropes and the recipes. The season of rebirth. As everything begins to burst forth with new life, we're pleased to usher in a new chapter of Cowboys and Indians. The premier magazine of the West has joined the growing lifestyle brand and media company Teton Ridge. With our 30th anniversary on the horizon in 2023, we're riding into the future with both devotion to the magazine's legacy and excitement for the trail ahead. For all that's in this issue and for all that lies ahead, we invite you to join us in our continuing journey into the West. CNI's new chapter. With its 30th anniversary on the horizon, CNI rides into the future with both devotion to its legacy and excitement for the trail ahead. During his two-decade-plus tenure as owner and publisher of Cowboys and Indians magazine, Greg Brown has seen the American West change and evolve substantially. The Western lifestyle and culture have a naturally expanding audience. As the years have gone by since we've owned the magazine, there have been more and more people who've fallen in love with the West, be it a place or a state of mind, Brown says. Brown, a longtime landowner and rancher himself, cherishes the connection between the people of the American West and the natural beauty and authentic culture surrounding them. He has guided CNI since the year 2000 with that ethos and a mission to communicate the West's greatest attributes to anyone who picks up an issue. The original decision to become owner and publisher of the magazine was an easy one, Brown says. He had been a subscriber himself and had a business partner who was already involved with CNI. The content was presented so well, and it was content you couldn't find anywhere else. Over the years since, Brown has worked closely with countless editors, writers, visual teams, digital professionals, artists, vendors, and, of course, Western entertainment icons who have graced covers. He's been intimately involved in all planning and publishing aspects of CNI. I've made lifelong friends with staff, readers, vendors, artists, and entertainers. CNI has grown into an extended family for me, he says. Recognizing the changing media landscape, the focus on new technologies and platforms and their effects on legacy publications, Brown decided in recent years to begin looking for a partner to help usher the magazine into its next chapter and beyond. Seeing the potential for CNI's continuing reach and engagement worldwide, he decided late last year to enter into a new ownership agreement with the American-owned, multi-platform company Teton Ridge, a growing brand that is, by definition, devoted to the Western way of life. Cowboy and Indians magazine joins Teton Ridge's stable, which also includes the American Rodeo, Equestrian Training Facility, TR9 Ranch, and ground-level involvement with elite-level quarter horses and athletes. There's an outreach component to the organization that benefits the Justin Cowboy Crisis Fund, Protect the Harvest, the Reining Horse Foundation, the conservation efforts of Yellowstone Forever, and other Western initiatives. With the magazine's future in mind, it was important to find the right partner to move forward, Brown says. I thought it was important to the legacy to get some other people involved, some with resources that would continue to expand the exposure. Teton Ridge founder and self-made entrepreneur Thomas Tull turned out to be the right partner. Teton Ridge has assumed ownership of the magazine, but Brown will stay involved in his publisher's role. What impressed me about Thomas Tull was he had the resources and the vision to bring greater exposure to the West in the proper way, Brown says. He is the right guy, and it was the right time, and I'm excited to work with Teton Ridge. Before founding Teton Ridge and bringing CNI into its fold, Tull built his career in the service, entertainment, professional sports, and technology industries. Tull formerly served as chairman and CEO of Legendary Entertainment, the film's company behind such box office smashes as The Dark Knight, The Hangover, and Jurassic World. He's also part owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers. But it was a lifelong appreciation for Western heritage and culture that spurred Tull to found Teton Ridge. Having bought and tended to his own ranches in recent years, Tull discovered a kinship with Brown in their discussions preceding the sale of CNI. Both self-made entrepreneurs and committed stewards of the land, they see CNI's approach to covering the West as an extension of that stewardship. This wasn't transactional for Greg, Tull says. He cares very deeply about it. I love the way he communicates and his vision. At the same time, I love the fact that he said, "Hey, we've got ideas, but I want to hear your ideas, too." CNI is authentic, but it's aspirational, Tull says. Anytime I would walk into a lodge or a ranch, the magazine was always there. I always considered it part of the tapestry. While committed to the magazine's history and what it covers, Tull sees the potential for greater engagement and exposure to readers who haven't yet discovered its breadth of content. There are different mediums to enjoy the same content, Tull says. You can look at other examples of beloved magazines that now have a wider voice. So that's what we want to do. Invest in and expand this magazine and this voice that we all admire. As for Teton Ridge's larger mission, Tull says it's about further expanding the live events that we have, the athletes that we have, from our barrel racing lineup to our amazing riders that we have across reining cow horses, cutting, and Western bloodstock, making sure that we're helping to cultivate the very best quarter horses in the country. Tull hopes for larger audiences and greater access to the sports and athletes supported by Teton Ridge. A connection to the West and a passion for horses go hand in hand for Tull. If you don't ride and haven't had that experience of an almost telepathic bond with a horse, then it's hard to get your head around. riding out on trails and deep into the forest so that you can feel there's not a telephone pole, there's not a mark of civilization. It's one of my favorite things to do. Aside from his experiences traveling, ranching, and riding horses, Toll credits his fascination with Western films as a source of the inspiration that's led him to his new ventures. Off the top of his head, he lists his favorite films as Unforgiven, Tombstone, The Outlaw Josie Wales, The Magnificent Seven, Open Range, and a new one he just saw that he says blew him away, Old Henry. I've always loved Westerns, Toll says, and now we're going to have the opportunity to do some things in that genre. You're fortunate in life if you can put yourself in a position to be around and among the things that you love. Find out more about Teton Ridge at TetonRidge.com or CowboysIndians.com. Good as gold. Hike Breckenridge in that perfect autumnal lull between summer and winter, and no matter what direction you choose, you're golden. By Jordan Rain. You'd like to think you can always depend on a local cowboy to point you in the right direction. Better yet, three of them. Idling together atop a wooden fence in a picture-perfect pocket of Rocky Mountain country on a fine fall day, each extending a casual finger or thumb toward the trail. The problem is this. They're all pointing in different directions. In Breckenridge, Colorado, you'll find this jocular trio kicking back at 309 North Main Street in front of an historic log cabin that's now the administrative headquarters of the Breckenridge Heritage Alliance. The three of them have been sitting here like bronze statues, which they are, since 1997, when artist Stephen Hansen's Three Cowboys sculpture was installed alongside a commemorative plaque that reads, "They all agreed, the trail is that way." Someplace else, this might be a confusing message, but in the heart of Summit County during fall hiking season, it's accurate enough. Pick any direction, and you're golden. Perched at nearly 10,000 feet at the base of the 10-mile range, the storied town of Breckenridge, best known for its lofty ski hills, summer offerings, and old-world resort town steeped in modern comforts and gold mining lore, is high among the finest spots west of the Northeast to witness mass chlorophyll breakdown before all the powder arrives. Autumn color at these elevations generally peaks in early to mid-September, lending Breckenridge the semi-plausible, if totally unverifiable, claim, touted by many, a local shoulder season copywriter, of being the first place in the lower 48 to see the leaves change. The point is, you do need time to time it right. One premature storm here and whoosh, show's over. All those amber waves of granite are bare. You're still good, I'm reassured by the check-in clerk in the empty lobby of Mountain Thunder Lodge, a modern rustic compound of condos plunked at the base of the ski resort's Teton-esque row of numbered peaks. Soon enough, this place will be abuzz with clunking ski boots and hot tub traffic. On October 1st, arriving for 3 days of hopefully still magical-ish autumn hiking, I appear to have the whole place to myself and wonder if I'm pressing my luck time-wise. Have I missed it? The lodge's leafy grounds look promising enough, dotted with rustling yellow aspens. From a distant glance, strands of autumn color are still strewn through the valley and surrounding hills. Right now is the best time to be in Breck, confirms my front desk authority, whispering with faux secrecy, even though there's zero risk of our being overheard at the moment. Just keep it to yourself. You are in the best place at the best time, but please do us a favor and don't tell the whole world about it. It's a local Breckenridge refrain I'll hear repeatedly during the three near-perfect days in early October, with autumn hanging on by a gazillion or so tenacious stems. Here are three easy pieces of fantastic fall hiking. But mum's the word. If you're arriving in Breckenridge from significantly lower elevations, and who isn't, trekking up two flights of stairs can be a mild enough shock to your hemoglobin-starved system on day one. The three-part remedy before delving into miles of hiking trails starting at 10,000 feet, acclimatization, hydration, and leisurely circumnavigation through the town's compact historic district and scenic mountain roads to get your bearings, adjust your lungs, and satisfy any cravings for locally made candles and soaps, loose teas and hemp, and CBD products, spa services, homemade ice cream and jerky, yoga classes, elk medallions, Vietnamese pho, and virtually any cuisine in between, plus enough old West footnotes sprinkled across nine museums to fill half of Denver. The five-block walk along historic Main Street, Breckenridge, with its rows of preserved log and clapboard facades and sleepy bungalows, home to myriad galleries, eateries, whimsically named indie shops, the joy of socks, historic saloons, and some of the most uncorporate-looking North Face, Marmot, and Starbucks outlets in hiding, can easily take a few hours at a solidly relaxed clip. My Main Street tour includes an edifying stroll through the Breckenridge Welcome Center and Museum, where the town's gold-excavating origins and 1960s resort rebirth are thoroughly mined. Across the street is the Barney Ford Victorian Home, commemorating the extraordinary Barney L. Ford, 1882-1902, an escaped African-American slave from Virginia turned successful Western entrepreneur, civil rights pioneer, and distinguished Breckenridgean, who is also now honored at the Colorado State Capitol. Hiding a few blocks from here is the town's nascent arts district, where I sign up for an evening herbal apothecary class offered through Breck Create, a multidisciplinary nonprofit organization designed to promote art, culture, and creative experiences with local artisans. Enough said. For a tiny town, Breckenridge is plenty expansive. When it's time to yank yourself out of Main Street meandering mode, Boreas Pass Road awaits at the south end of town for that classic scenic mountain drive and optional warm-up walk with phenomenal bird's-eye views of the valley and beyond. The historic route, once plied by old prospectors and a long-gone 1880s narrow-gauge railroad, climbs nearly 2,000 feet to the Continental Divide, straddling a pair of national forests and offering unbeatable autumn alpine valley vistas along the way. Pulling over somewhere on the Pacific side of the divide in White River National Forest, I log my first Breckenridge Fall hike, a mellow roadside stroll through a lightly falling confetti of golden aspen leaves. Groves of the iconic Colorado autumn tree flank the route, almost tunnel-like at certain points, interspersed with panoramic views of the 10-mile range, framed by glassy alpine lakes, thick swaths of yellow, the occasional dab of ambitious orange, and a miniaturized Breckenridge thousands of feet below, about the length of an index finger from up here. On any given glorious fall afternoon, hanging in the mid-60s, you won't be alone on Boreas Pass. Locals and visitors alike stream by in various modes of conveyance. How can you tell who's who? The old Winnebago with Arkansas plates skidding past, kicking up a brief storm of dirt road, is an easy enough call. Thank you, visitor. Afternoon, bellows a voice from a posse of bicyclists with bionic Colorado quads, pedaling uphill without breaking a sweat or showing any acknowledgement whatsoever of pushing 11,000 feet of elevation. Locals, I'm safely betting. Whoof, huffs a guy taking a load off bed beside an old 19th century water tank perched near the confluence of Boreas Pass Road, a burbling stream, and some single track. A moment later, he lies back and stares into the deep blue Colorado sky with glazed contentment. Visitor, I conclude, briefly closing my eyes. But I sure wouldn't mind pretending to be a local in this spot. Back in Breckenridge's gold fever heydecades, 1880s to 1920s, when 1 million troy ounces, nearly 60 tons of pay dirt, were coaxed out of the ground with riverbed dredges, hillside hydraulics, and whatever other emerging corporate mining ingenuities could crush pristine Rocky Mountain terrain into lucrative rubble, it's safe to say that very little attention was paid to serving the future needs of 21st century hikers. That's just one of those happy silver linings in French Gulch. The former mining hub, tucked in a neighboring valley just east of Breckenridge, is now outfitted with what must be one of the finest inadvertently created trail systems in the Rockies, compliments of a bygone mining effort inspired by a staple corporate motto back then that industry is always to be preferred to scenic beauty. It was very beautiful what they destroyed, but look at what we have now, says Lee Gervin, guiding me on a 5-hour foot tour through a network of mining roads and burro trails reclaimed by hikers, winter cross-country skiers, and lush yellow hillsides right now. All of these aspen groves moved into the open hills that were completely demolished, so the forests were essentially remade by all the mining activity. And there are now tons of repurposed trails to choose from, thanks to our mining legacy, Gervin adds, because miners certainly knew how to build trails. So, hey, not too bad in the end. Gervin, a Breckenridge Heritage Alliance docent, cultural preservationist, and wealth of local knowledge, past and present, knows this richly textured valley stuffed with mining history, colorful characters, and dogged natural beauty like her own backyard, which it basically is. Looping through old forested roads, riverbank trails, and hilly footpaths with playful names like B&B, XIOU8, and V3, as in Veni Vidi Vici, we pass solemn mining relics at almost every turn. Rusty buckets dating back to the 1930s, during last-ditch gold-digging efforts here, hang on tree branches like Depression-era decor. Giant pieces of corroded hose pipe, designed to water-blast forested hills into unforested ones, lie beside the trail like metal bones, dry and dormant for over a century, overtaken by forested hills again. At one point, Gervin spots some shards of white fragments and rusted empty tin cans strewn in the trees just off the trail. No, not junk. History. Chinaware, she tells me, as we pull over to take a closer look. This is over a century old, and these cans date back to the 1880s. Probably evaporated milk to make that dreadful coffee they drank back then slightly more palatable. You can tell their age from these lap seams, Gervin adds, running a finger over a strangely rounded-looking edge of the tin. That's how they designed them before the modern-day can opener was invented around World War I. small bits of purple glass, perhaps from a perfume bottle, turn up in this mix of 140-year-old domesticity, just lying there in the woods like 1880 was last week. Then a piece of an old stove appears a few feet away. What was this place? We're likely standing on the site of a former crib, or even a community of cribs, Gervin surmises. What's a crib? Gervin was waiting for me to ask. It's the home of an independent prostitute, she says. A little older, working for herself, a rugged independent amidst all the mining crews stationed out here. We'll call her Rattlesnake Butte Mary. Gervin decides, leading us back to the trail and leaving the remains of Mary's cozy crib to woodsy eternity. Breckenridge's trademark mining leftovers are its dredge piles, giant mounds of broken granite carved up by dredges that occupied the area's gulches and river valleys for nearly half a century of unregulated gold scouring. By the 1940s, these rocks would nearly entomb a mined-out town practically buried in rubble before Breckenridge's successful resort revival and its extensive environmental reparations began decades later. In French Gulch, dredge piles still cover vast sections of the valley floor like heavy reminders. This is what we call the rock garden, says Gervin, leading me along a thin, gravelly trail, winding through massive dunes of crushed detritus that will one day be as puzzling as Stonehenge. The technical name for these lifeless gray piles, I'm told, is swales. Each swale was an 8-hour shift, Gervin says, as we swale hop past the preserved remains of the riling dredge, decaying in a shallow pond like a strangely designed ship built in precisely the wrong place. In fact, it was an ingenious carving contraption of its day, a floating gold mine and processing plant in one. It would efficiently slice off multiple square yards of riverbed in one fell swoop and sluice it into giant profits. One of the 9 dredges operating throughout Summit County from the 1890s until World War II, collectively known as the Breckenridge Navy, the Riling sank here in 1922. But not before pulling an estimated $7 million in gold out of French Gulch with its long-gone sister dredge, the Reliance. Ascending from the river along a spruce-lined trail, we pass abandoned hippie cabins hiding in the pines, old mining shafts reclaimed by later 20th century squatters up into the 1990s. Along the way, Gervin tells me about other cabin-dwelling figures of yore who once roamed this gulch. There's Buck's Cabin, named after a local recluse who dressed in buckskin and ended up in jail for attempting to blow his place up when a realtor dropped by to evict him. And Floyd's Cabin, named after a local backwoods rent collector for legions of hippies camping out on private land. All of them checked out years ago, one way or another. Eventually, we reach the crest of the forest, where the skeletal remains of a deep mine shaft, named after a certain Sally Barber, are perched on a hillside of lifeless gray rock tailings spiked with bits of iron pyrite, fool's gold, sparkling in the sun like a lousy old joke. Below us is a spectacular panorama of pine and aspen-studded hills. Off in some nearby trees, Gervin points to another cache of century-old lead tins, because of people didn't know any better back then, strewn among the pine cones. So who was this Sally Barber character that the mineshaft is named after? I ask Gervin, preparing myself for the best French Gulch tale yet. I'm glad you asked, she says. I have no idea. Probably somebody's mother. During the summer, you won't find a parking spot, even if you get here this early, Nate Penny tells me, pulling us into an empty lot at the Mohawk Lakes trailhead in an old Subaru Outback with a cracked windshield and a baby seat in the back. Instant mountain guide street cred. In July, you'll be parking way down the road and hiking with a crowd of people. Not in early October. At 8.06 a.m. on a Wednesday, one of the most popular hiking routes in the area, Spruce Creek Trail to Mohawk Lakes, will be all ours, Nate assures me. We may run into a moose at some point along the way, he clarifies. They're everywhere around here. A laid-back, instantly likable hiking, backpacking, and rock-climbing guide, sporting the requisite beard and formal beer-brewing pedigree, his other career, Nate is exactly the type of guy you want taking you on a gold standard hike to some picturesque alpine lakes hiding in the hills just a few miles south of Breckenridge. It may get a little gusty up on top by the lakes, but it's awesome here around this time, says Nate, who leads trips all over the area for Colorado Adventure Guides. Tomorrow, he tells me, he'll be taking a group up nearby 14,265-foot Quandary Peak, the only 14er in the 10-mile range and the 13th highest mountain in the state. Today, it's an easier 7-mile round-trip walkabout up a sub-peak along the Spruce Creek Trail, a bouldery mountain path furnished with bulging tree roots, leaning canopies of Sitka spruce, and lay little wooden bridges over trickling creeks and moss-covered logs straight out of a Grimm's fairy tale set piece. And as promised, no crowds. This is my favorite month in Breckenridge, Nate notes, right on cue, which I'll never tire of hearing during this trip. You're in the best place at the best time. Just this perfect lull between all that summer and all that winter. Passing a broad alpine meadow covered in tall yellow grass and presumably at least one camouflaged moose named Waldo hiding somewhere in this picture, we hear the faint inviting sounds of thundering water. Another mile or so of uphill tromping and the payoff appears near the tree line. Constitution Falls, rumbling down a long tiered cliff before vanishing into the pines. Theories abound about why encountering a wild cascade of water almost anywhere other than a shopping mall can inspire sneaking feelings of pure happiness and serenity just like that. One recent explanation breaks it down to molecular science, specifically negative air ions. Being in the presence of negative, but otherwise very positive, charges retained by air molecules in highly humidified natural pockets like waterfalls produces a natural mood-reviving effect without the aid of a dry, ion-deficient pharmacy. Or so the happy theory goes. Grabbing a quick breather and some euphoric ionization by the edge of the falls, I take in the whole scene. All joy-inducing molecules aside, it's hard to imagine even the crustiest mood being a match for this gorgeous fall mountainscape under a deep blue Colorado sky with a meditative aqueous soundtrack to boot. It's even nicer at the top of the falls, promises Nate, leading the way up a rocky scramble past yet another abandoned mining cabin, to the source, Lower Mohawk Lake, an alpine oasis rippling above the valley like an infinity pool. Just one more spectacle out here that's tough to tear your eyes and feet from. Want to stop for lunch? Nate asks. Well, we could, but on the other hand, it's just a short climb to Upper Mohawk Lake. Maybe even more negative ions and even greater picturesque sandwich-eating potential await just over the next ridge. Impulsively, turning away from the lake and heading back to the trail, I'm halted by a rogue gust of mountain wind that suddenly snatches my hat right off my head like a giant hand and sends it tumbling toward the water's edge. I dash back to the lake, I grab my hat in the nick of time. I trot back to the trail, then I stop when something hits me. The perfect place, at the perfect time. Right here, right now, in the ever-fleeting but always available present moment. Look no further. Sure, let's stop for lunch.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.